A missing couple is found safe after getting their car stuck in snow for a week. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you why more and more hunters carry bear spray. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the Montana Kids Count director, Tala Dillon, about the importance of early childhood education. A Wisconsin couple reported missing after a visit to Yellowstone National Park was found safe on the Beartooth Highway, where their car had been stuck for nearly a week. Park County, Wyoming Sheriff spokesman Lance Mathis says the owner of a guest ranch heard about the missing couple and went looking for them on his snowmobile. He found them at about 8:30 a.m. this morning and took them back to the guest ranch. Mathis says Mark and Christine Wathke of Cornell, Wisconsin were cold and hungry, but otherwise okay. They were last seen leaving the northeast entrance of Yellowstone at 4 p.m. last Tuesday. They had hotel reservations in Miles City that night, but never arrived. Mathis says they either didn't see or ignored signs that said the Beartooth Highway was closed due to the weather.
And in other news from around the state, a state judge has ordered Montana authorities to recalculate how much is owed by a Wyoming mining company that challenged its $3.4 million tax bill. Today's ruling from District Judge Jeffrey Sherlock of Helena concerned Cloud Peak Energy's sale of coal to affiliates that it partially owns. The state alleges that Gillette Wyoming Company undervalued coal that it sold between 2005 and 2007 and paid too little in taxes as a result. But Sherlock says tax authorities erred in coming up with a value for Cloud Peak's coal based on when it was shipped. He says the value should be based on when the sales contract was signed. The practice of selling coal to affiliated companies is also under scrutiny by federal regulators investigating royalties on coal shipped to Asia.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Montana has notified thousands of customers it is raising premiums 3.5% in January because of taxes and fees included in the new federal health care law. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports notices dated Thursday were mailed to holders of group policies that insure tens of thousands of Montanans. Some of the policyholders signed contracts earlier this year and are getting a mid-contract premium increase. State law generally forbids that, but makes exceptions for changes in state or federal laws. Blue Cross said the increases are due to changes that take effect on January 1st, a flat rate federal tax on all health insurers to help pay the costs of the Affordable Care Act, and a $63 per person annual reinsurance fee that will help pay for high-cost claims.
A state judge has ordered a mental evaluation for a Colorado man charged with killing an eastern Montana teacher. Today, District Judge Richard Simonton ordered Michael Keith Spell committed to Montana State Hospital for up to 30 days at the request of his defense attorneys. The examination could determine if Spell is fit for trial. His attorneys contend Spell is mentally disabled and unable to understand the case against him. The 24-year-old from Parachute, Colorado, is charged with felony murder and attempted kidnapping in the January 2012 death of Sydney High School teacher Sherry Arnold. Simonton says that absent, quote, extraordinary circumstances, end quote, he had no intention of rescheduling Spell's trial, scheduled to begin January 6th. Co-defendant Lester Van Waters Jr. pleaded guilty in a deal with prosecutors.
United Way of Missoula County announced today it's hired its first coordinator of an ambitious plan to end homelessness in the community. Michael Moore previously worked as United Way's community impact manager. Moore also had a 27-year career at the Missoulian newspaper. United Way's chief executive officer, Susan Hay Patrick, says his roots run deep in Missoula County.
He is well-known in the community, very, very knowledgeable about the community, and tells me that he has enjoyed transitioning to a different role where he can speak up and advocate for things in a way that newspaper reporters and editors aren't able to do.
Patrick concedes the city-county effort to find a way to end homelessness in Missoula is a bold and admittedly difficult plan.
Well, we're really going to swing for the fences on this one. I think, like with any seemingly intractable problem, that you need to put a stake in the ground and say that we are going to get it done. I think if you aim short, you fall short. And we really believe, and the experiences of other communities nationwide show us, that it is possible to, within 10 years, make tremendous progress toward housing people, rehousing people, and truly addressing homelessness for once and for all.
She says there's a lot to do during the plan's initial startup.
The early phases of the plan call for better coordination of services, for a single point of entry, which is something that we have lacked in Missoula, working with the steering committee to develop a funding pool for homeless prevention emergency funds and housing startup costs that, for example, that first and last month's rent and security deposit that are barriers for so many people who have jobs but just can't save that money to get into housing. Involving more community members in implementing the plan so that we can increase awareness of homelessness, its causes, its solutions, and working with the many, many good soldiers in the field who work with housing and issues and homeless people every day, and making sure that their efforts align with the 10-year plan.
Moore first came to the United Way of Missoula County in June of 2012 and eventually became one of the authors of the plan to end local homelessness. That plan was approved by the City Council and County Commissioners this past April.
A 57-year-old Great Falls woman has died after a one-vehicle rollover crash on Interstate 15 near Craig. The Montana Highway Patrol says the vehicle was southbound between 6 and 6:30 a.m. this morning when a 59-year-old Great Falls man lost control of the vehicle on an icy bridge. The car went off the road, slid down an embankment, and rolled twice. Trooper Ben Havron tells the Great Falls Tribune the woman died at a Great Falls hospital. Her name has not been released. Both occupants were wearing seatbelts. The crash remains under investigation.
A 28-year-old Texas man is jailed in Gallatin County after prosecutors say he was trying to hit pedestrians with his sport utility vehicle near a Bozeman bar. Brian Curtis Palak of Louisville, Texas, made an initial appearance in Gallatin County Justice Court today on a charge of felony criminal endangerment. Justice of the Peace Brian Adams sent Palak's bail at $50,000. Court records say Palak was arrested Friday night after people reported someone driving an Isuzu SUV was trying to hit pedestrians. Witnesses say the SUV hit a one-way street sign and a bar sign before driving onto the sidewalk and toward a group of people. The people hid behind a tree. Witnesses say the SUV hit another tree and became disabled after hitting a light pole. Witnesses detained Palak.
A Billings woman is charged with drunken driving while taking her 13-year-old daughter and two friends trick-or-treating. The Billings Gazette reports 34-year-old Summer Breeze Merrill also is charged with three counts of felony child endangerment. She made an initial appearance in Yellowstone County Justice Court on Friday, where the bail was set at $20,000. She is scheduled to appear in district court on Thursday. Court records say Merrill was driving the girls around a neighborhood at about 7 p.m. Thursday when she started arguing with her daughter. The other girls said Merrill stopped the car, kicked them out, and continued to drive. The friends called 911 and reported they thought they saw Merrill drinking alcohol.
Montana's 54 state parks had their best summer ever this past summer, with over 1.5 million visits. That's up 5% over the previous summer and the best summer on record. State Parks Administrator Chaz Van Genderen attributes the growth in part to an innovative funding policy.
The vehicle registration, we were the first state in the country to move to that approach to paying for park system. And it's been well embraced by Montanans, and they just continue to come. $6 a year on your vehicle registration as an option you can pay, and Montanans are taking advantage of it.
75% of the state park visitors are residents, and the 25% who are visiting from out of state is a number that is growing.
When we instituted the campsite reservation system a couple years back, that really helped people. You know, when gas is $3.50 a gallon and you're coming over here from Spokane or coming over from Minneapolis or up from Salt Lake, you want to be able to plan ahead. So we saw an increase in non-resident use once we started allowing them to, you know, just make sure that they had a place to stay at night.
Giant Springs State Park in Great Falls had the highest number of visitors of all the state parks this past summer. Van Genderen says Montanans see the value of the state park experience.
Montana State Parks are great value, $15 a night for a campsite as a resident. You know, hotels 80 to 100 nowadays, and Montanans live outdoors. We still enjoy camping.
Even with all the support, Van Genderen says Montana's state park system is one of the most austere in the region and is facing a maintenance backlog. Next summer, the state park system will celebrate its 75th anniversary.
A new one-minute video may be shown soon on your favorite outdoor channel, urging hunters to carry bear spray. The new video was produced by the Wildlife Management Institute and the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee. Committee spokesman Chris Servine says even though hunters are armed, bear spray is a better choice for protecting both the hunter and the bear.
And if they take firearms as their first self-defense approach with bears, many times they can kill the bear, which they might not have to do if they're using something like bear spray. The alternative is that they can wound a bear and make the bear angry and result in even more aggression. Bear spray is a very effective way to deter bears that are inquisitive or even aggressive and do it in a non-lethal way to the bear.
The new video demonstrates how to properly use bear spray and features well-known hunting journalist Craig Boddington.
We wanted to get him as a spokesman because he's a very credible hunter, and he's carrying the message too. And you know, it's one thing to get this message from a conservation point of view, but it's really a much more effective way to have a fellow hunter, particularly a well-admired hunter like Craig, to be carrying the message. And by enlisting him, we hope to get more hunters to be thinking positively about carrying and using spray.
If you do carry bear spray, Servine says it's important to carry it in a way that you can reach it quickly.
Because most of the time when you encounter bear in the backcountry, it's going to be a very, very quick situation, just a matter of seconds before the bear is either going to charge or get very close to you. And so you have to be able to get the spray out. And what we encourage people to do is carry it in a place where it's easily accessible to them, maybe a holster or a pocket, something they can reach to instantly. And they should practice getting it out, removing the safety, and getting ready to spray.
Conflicts between hunters and grizzly bears have increased in recent years. Another reason for hunters to carry bear spray.
A new report produced by the Annie E. Casey Foundation concludes that Americans should do more to promote early childhood education. The Kids Count Policy report titled The First 8 Years, Giving Kids a Foundation, points out a child's early years are critically important. In tonight's feature interview with Everett O'Brien, Montana Kids Count Director Tala Dillon says the information a child absorbs during his or her first 8 years of life could have lifelong implications.
The first 8 years are kind of your window of opportunity to fully develop a child's brain. It's when the child's brain is the most elastic, when the cognitive and social and emotional and language skills are easily assimilated.
So those little brains are just absorbing everything and starting to link everything together?
Exactly. They're like little sponges. And like you said, linkages in the brain are being formed as a foundation for future learning.
Montana, aside for just a second, tell us about this national analysis called the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study.
Like the title says, it's a longitudinal study that has followed children from kindergarten and on up, focusing on how their cognitive development is evolving based on the conditions.
And it found that 36% of American kids were on track in cognitive knowledge and skills. That mm-hmm. doesn't seem like a very big number.
No, it doesn't. I think the cognitive abilities of children is an aspect of development that we have overlooked, as it were, in favor of other things. You know, you have social skills, you have emotional skills, you have language skills that are much more, concrete and more clear in people's minds. But then when it comes to cognitive skills, it's a little bit vague, and it's something that we haven't really, learned a lot about, I don't think.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because it's harder to grasp. It is also harder to do something about and harder to measure.
And as you mentioned, 56% of these children were on track in terms of their physical well-being, 70% in their social and emotional growth, 74% in school engagement. But again, those cognitive skills pale in comparison.
Exactly. And it goes to show that it's easier to focus on these more concrete aspects of child development.
And also these cognitive skill numbers nationally, they get a bit more troubling when you go further down the economic scale, and especially for kids of color, yeah?
Exactly. Non-white children and children who live in low-income and poor families are definitely worse off.
Okay, let's drill down a bit and talk about Montana. 60% of 3- and 4-year-olds attend preschool. Now, at first blush, to the uninitiated like myself, that doesn't seem like such a bad number.
No, it doesn't. But then you consider preschool and child care. And the line between them is blurry in this state because we do not, as of yet, have a fully developed rating system and curriculum that distinguishes child care from preschool. And in many people's eyes, preschool is just another word for daycare. And unless you have a learning experience built into your care situation for your child, the cognitive development is not going to be helped forward by it.
So what does happen in preschool, generally speaking?
In preschool, there is a set curriculum, exactly like there is in kindergarten and in elementary school and all the way up through college. There are certain things that children are meant to learn in terms of shape recognition, color recognition, language skills, early shaping of numbers and recognition of numbers and letters. It's the same skills that emerge and that you need in kindergarten. Just, you start instilling these skills and this knowledge at an earlier stage, and that way the repetition creates that cognitive advantage.
Only 22% of Montana kids under the age of 6 have received developmental screenings. What is that, a developmental screening, and why is that important?
You know, I got to be honest with you. I don't know exactly what happens during a developmental screening. I know my kids certainly haven't had one, but it does screen for behavioral and mental health issues. The goal is to catch these issues early so that they can be addressed and, compensated for if needed, and so they don't surface to a, much more serious degree in later years.
So what is the state of Montana doing to improve these numbers?
The state of Montana has instituted something called the Best Beginnings Advisory Council, which is headed out of the Department of Public Health and Human Services Early Childhood Services Bureau. They are working to move early childhood education out of the silos that it has been working in forever, really. Streamlining funding options, they're instituting a quality rating system. It's in its development stages. They do have established early childhood milestone measures that are available on their website for caregivers and parents to look and see, how is my child tracking in these different developmental realms.
Is this expensive? Are these measures expensive to do?
No. It takes attention, it takes time, it takes engagement, but it does not take a lot of money.
What more would the foundation, would Kids Count like to see get done?
They have 3 kind of broad policy recommendations that they are putting forth. The first is to support parents so that they can care and provide for their children more effectively. By that, they mean that states and the federal government should make it easier for parents to navigate all these programs that are available that help families aligning and streamlining the services available to them. Number 2 is to increase the access to high-quality birth through 8 programs, and then beginning with investments that target low-income children. Research shows that the biggest difference in cognitive development can be seen in giving low-income, slightly disadvantaged children a quality preschool experience. Also, states should develop comprehensive integrated programs and data systems that are able to address all the aspects of a child's development, not just grades and behavior, detention, and so forth. That will support children's transition to elementary school and then further other programs related to school-age children.
Sounds like a lot of work, but I would assume you think it's very worth the time and the money.
I would think so. I mean, you take care of your car, right? You rotate the tires, you change the oil, if something sounds slightly off, you take your car into the mechanic so that you can fix these things before they become costly problems. It's the same thing.
Tala Dillon is director of Montana Kids Count.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, expect partly cloudy skies and patchy freezing fog with lows 14 to 21 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and patchy freezing fog. Highs should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Central Montana, tonight expect partly cloudy skies and isolated snow showers, mainly in the mountains, with lows 15 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with a chance of snow in the western mountains and highs 35 to 40 degrees. Southwest Montana, there's a winter storm warning in effect until 11 p.m. this evening for elevations above 7,000 feet for Gallatin County. Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with snow in the mountains and isolated snow in the valleys with lows 10 to 15 degrees. And tomorrow, expect increasing clouds with a chance of snow in the mountains in the afternoon, highs 30 to 40 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 31 degrees with mostly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 34 degrees. Butte has 25 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Great Falls is partly cloudy with 29 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under partly cloudy skies is 30 degrees. It's 27 degrees and partly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's mostly cloudy and 30 degrees. Libby has 32 with cloudy conditions. And in Polson, the skies are cloudy and it's 33 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
The oil boom in the Bakken area of Montana and North Dakota has led to the influx of a large number of workers attracted by the relatively high-wage jobs associated with oil exploration and development. Roughnecks, truck drivers, pipe fitters, material handlers, railroad workers, etc. Workers are traveling hundreds of miles from their homes and families to take these jobs, some of them living temporary quarters in the Bakken and commuting back home on weekends and other breaks. During the very slow recovery from the Great Recession, these high-paying jobs have certainly been a godsend to many of the workers and their families. The revenues generated for state governments have also helped keep the state's budgets balanced without deep cuts in services. Whether this is a good model for economic development, however, may be another question. Oil and gas companies understandably want to suggest that it is. After all, if their private interests in that development can be wrapped in the public interest, merging the two, then oil companies are in a better position to lobby for special privileges for themselves, such as reduced taxes and relaxed environmental regulations. Law enforcement officials and social welfare agencies, however, seem to be telling a different story about the impact of the boom on the livability of the Bakken communities being impacted. The cost of living in the region has skyrocketed primarily because of the shortage of housing and the rapid rise in housing costs. This has put pressure on existing residents who were renting and are being squeezed out by the population crush. Inequality, not surprisingly, is on the rise. The population boom is overwhelmingly male. Many of the new workers are being put up in hastily constructed man camps. The crowding of young males with money to spend into rural towns has had fairly familiar consequences. A recent study from North Dakota State University looked at the impact of the Bakken oil boom on crime and policing. It found that the calls to police for assistance had skyrocketed. In Watford City, in the middle of the North Dakota Bakken, with its exploding population, police service calls increased by over 100-fold between 2008 and 2011, from 25 calls per year to 3,900. For the police forces in other counties and towns in the Bakken, the increase has not been this extreme, but they have put law enforcement on the defensive. The Williston Police Department, for instance, saw calls rise from 5,500 to 16,000 in that same four-year period. The increased volume of calls for police services was associated with alcohol-related crimes such as bar fights, disorderly conduct, and drunk driving. Drug problems rose dramatically, especially those associated with meth. Domestic violence was the cause of many of the increased number of calls to the police, aggravated assault and assault with weapons, etc. Theft and burglary calls were up. Traffic accidents had increased dramatically. Prostitution skyrocketed as local hotels, motels, and bars became centers for ongoing prostitution rings. This rapid expansion of crime in the Bakken has caught the attention of federal law enforcement agencies who have been reinforcing their presence there. Federal agents see the Bakken crime boom as similar to earlier regional crime waves, the cocaine cowboys of South Florida in the 1970s and 1980s, and the heyday of the street gangs in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles in the early 1990s. It seems unlikely that many of us would consider this an ideal economy and community in which to live and raise a family, even if the amount of money circulating in the local economy increased dramatically. One has to be careful about judging well-being by average income. That can be quite misleading. For instance, back in the 1880s, Montana had the second highest per capita income of all American states and territories. Recently, Montana has been among the poorest quarter of the states by that measure. The Mountain West as a whole had per capita incomes that were 70% above the national average in the 1880s. Now the Mountain West is the second poorest in the nation, according to that statistic, beat out only by the Deep South. The primary reason for that per capita incomes being so high in Montana in 1880 was that almost all of the residents worked, and there were very few dependents that had to be supported by the income that was earned. There were 8 men for every 3 women. The men in general were young adults. That combination assured that there were not many children and certainly few elderly folks to be supported. The income earned by these young, single males did not have to support wives, children, or grandparents, so the residents appeared to be rich. It seems unlikely, however, that many people will find this peculiar demographic situation to be in any sense ideal or something that public policy should attempt to create. Early Montana was one large mining camp. The Bakken is vying for that status now and being plagued by many of the same problems. Although it is possible to see these mining camps as exciting places that are wide open and free of many of the stifling constraints of conventional morality, something that may be the dream of many a young man, few others would suggest that mining camps are models of social organization and the good life. Yet that is what the oil and gas industry is trying to sell us.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.